It occurs to me that hindsight is a wonderful thing. Being able to look back over things in your life, maybe all of you like me sort of wish I'd known when I was younger some of the things I know now, and could revisit some of the experiences I've had in the light of what I now know. It would make a great advantage. Hindsight is useful, of course, when you want to assess whether the pandemic has been handled properly by our government. In fact, poor old Keir Starmer gets nicknamed Captain Hindsight, I think, by the Prime Minister, because he's always saying, oh, should have done this earlier and you should have done that later, or whatever it was. And hindsight is a wonderful thing. If we've got it, then we could do things differently. Hindsight is very helpful too, of course, and when somebody dies, we can review their life and assess them, like the Duke of Edinburgh recently, of course. And hindsight gives us insight into things that maybe should have been done a bit better, like redecorating the flat at 10 Downing Street. All sorts of things hindsight helps us with. But of course, we can't live with hindsight day by day. We have to live with the moment. And the passage that was read for us, the story of Cleopas making his way to Emmaus on Easter Day, is a lovely story where we have hindsight. We can look back knowing that Jesus is risen from the dead. And of course, Cleopas didn't understand that at all at the moment. Everything for him had fallen apart. It was all a disaster. The cross, the death of Jesus, was the end of their hopes. He says, you know, we had hoped that he would be the one to redeem Israel, but of course he can't be because he's gone and life has come to an end, and it's dreadful. And we're living at the moment in those days between Easter and Whitsun, the coming of the Holy Spirit. And it's an interesting period and very important one, I think, in the New Testament, because it was during that period that Jesus was meeting and spending time with the disciples and helping them to look back through the lens of the fact that he was now risen, through the lens of the resurrection, to things that don't make sense without that. And Jesus was teaching them, just as he taught Cleopas and his companion on the road, you know, didn't you realize the scriptures have said this? This now makes sense. It should make sense to you. And by the time the 40 days were up after Jesus had risen, he had taught the disciples to look back and now make sense of things that hadn't made sense before. So what I want to do with you this morning, just for a little while, I hope it'll be a little while. Those of you who know me well know that little whiles get extended a little bit, but we'll see if we get on. I want to look back at the cross, because for Cleopas, the cross was total disaster. It made no sense at all. It was the end of any hope that they'd had in Jesus. And yet, with hindsight and with the lens of the resurrection, the cross takes on quite a different meaning. I've led loads of alpha courses in my ministry and lifetime, and one of the parts I always enjoy is talking about the resurrection. Many of you will know that I love preaching on the resurrection. I'm a great resurrection believer and Christian. And we talk about, if the resurrection happened, then Jesus must have been who he said he was, and so on. And then the next session of alpha begins, well, if Jesus was raised from the dead, what is his death all about? Why did that have to happen? And I just want to share a number of things that, with hindsight, we can now say about the death of Jesus and the cross that we couldn't have done at the time, and Cleopas couldn't at the time, but because Jesus is alive, we can now say loud and clear. And the first thing, and the overriding thing, is this: that Jesus did not die as a victim, victim of circumstances, victims of conspiracies, victims of those who wanted him dead. He wasn't at the mercy of things happening around him. That Jesus actually chose to die. It was his choice. Now, when you can look back on the life and ministry of Jesus with hindsight, you can see that there were a certain number of occasions when he may well have died, but didn't. The Christmas story reminds us he could have died as a little baby, a toddler, when Herod's troops came looking for any newborn boy born in Bethlehem. There were a number of occasions during his ministry when, at the start of his ministry, he was driven into the desert and the devil was tempting him. And one of the temptations was to throw himself off the pinnacle of the temple. If he'd done that, that would have been the end of him, presumably. When he preached at Nazareth up in Galilee in his hometown, they wanted to throw him off the cliff. And a number of times, his opponents pick up stones to throw at him, particularly in John's gospel on two occasions there, and Jesus just turns and walks through the midst. Now, we might think, if we just had that experience, that Jesus is somehow living a charmed life. But no, Jesus chooses to die. He says, "No one takes my life from me, I give it of myself." And in the latter stages of what we've been celebrating in Holy Week and the run-up to Easter, we realise that there were lots of occasions when Jesus could have avoided danger, but he didn't. He needn't have come to Jerusalem, but he did, where the opposition was gathering against him. When he rode into Jerusalem on Palm Sunday, he made a public display of himself. He announced his arrival. It was extremely provocative. And some of the things he said during Holy Week were not nice, peaceful things, you know, like love your neighbour and look after your cat and things. Jesus was saying stuff that was making people very angry. Jesus chose to die. When he'd had shared the Last Supper with the disciples, he didn't have to go into Gethsemane, where Judas thought he'd probably find him and did. They could have slunk off somewhere else quite safely. When he was on trial, when he was accused of stuff that he knew wasn't true, he could have explained that that wasn't the case. And when he was charged with, "Are you the Christ, the Son of the living God?" when he really ought to have kept quiet and not said anything, he just deliberately played into their hands and said, "Yes, I am, and you're going to see the Son of Man coming with the glory of heaven." It was quite deliberate. He chose to die. Jesus was no victim. He was in control of events and of the circumstances around them. Jesus chose to die. He predicted his death. He said it is what he had come for. And he set his face to Jerusalem. Even on the cross, there were people calling out saying, "Why don't you come down? If you're the Messiah, you can get out of this." And it must have been very tempting, but he didn't. He refused. And he gave up his spirit and died. So the first and overriding thing is that Jesus chose to die. This was part of God's plan for him. Now, following on from that, and quite interestingly, we can subdivide that heading and we can go on to say that Jesus actually chose where to die. Now, he could have died in Bethlehem if Herod's troops had found him as a little boy. He could have died out in the desert if he'd succumbed to temptation. You think of up in Galilee, remember the storm on the lake where the fishermen disciples were scared out of their wits that they were going to drown? Jesus could have drowned in the Sea of Galilee. He could have been thrown off a cliff in Nazareth, right up in the north, away in the country areas. But no, it had to be Jerusalem. And we're told in the Gospels that in the latter stage of his life, Jesus determined to go to Jerusalem. His family and his friends warned him and said, "No, don't go down there. There's danger down there." But Jesus said, "No, it's got to be Jerusalem." And why did it have to be Jerusalem? Well, Jerusalem, of course, was then, as it is now, the capital of Israel. It was where the temple was. It was where the faith of God's people was totally based. And the temple, of course, was for the Jews, the place where heaven met earth. It was the center of the universe. It was where God dwelt among his people and presenced himself there. It had to be Jerusalem. It couldn't happen out in the sticks somewhere where people might not hear about it or know about it, or it might just be seen as a factional group that didn't like Jesus very much. No, it had to be at the center. It had to be at the heart. And it's very interesting that Jerusalem, of course, is built on a number of hills. Mount Zion, we call it in the Old Testament often, and it's on a hill range. And one of those hills is Mount Moriah. Now, Mount Moriah, if it rings any bells, is the mountain on which Abraham was called by God to sacrifice his only son, Isaac, his only son whom he loved. And God told him to take his only son that he'd waited donkey's years to have and was part of the promise that one day he would be father to a great nation, a great family. And Abraham obediently took Isaac there and was ready to kill his son when God stepped in and provided a ram for the sacrifice. Now that was Mount Moriah. And here on that same group of hills, God's only son, whom he loves, is not substituted by an animal, but gives himself. It has to be Jerusalem, you see. But Jesus not only chose where to die, he chose when. Again, it could have been early in his life. It could have been before his ministry began, at any point during his ministry. John in his gospel tells us of two occasions when they were threatening to stone him and do away with him because of the claims he was making. One of those was at the Feast of Tabernacles, recorded in John 8. The other was at another feast, the Feast of Dedication, in John 10. But we might think, well, it doesn't really matter, does it, as long as Jesus died? But for Jesus, it did matter. And throughout John's gospel, Jesus has a phrase that he keeps using. He says, "My time has not yet come," or "the hour is not yet." You remember when Jesus turned water into wine at Cana in Galilee, and his mum comes along and says, "You know, they've run out of wine. Can you do something to help?" And Jesus is slightly rude to his mother, in our parlance at least, and says, "You know, woman, what have I to do with this?" And "My hour is not yet," he says. He had this real sense of timing, and this was part of his prayer to his father throughout his ministry. It wasn't just doing what his father wanted him to do, but doing it in the time that his father wanted him to do it. So when was the right time? The answer, of course, is Passover. Now, Mark tells us at the beginning of chapter 14 that those who were scheming to get rid of Jesus had decided they wouldn't move at Passover. There were too many people about. There were great festival. Jerusalem was crowded. You know, they'd caused too much trouble to move on Jesus at Passover. And it was only when Judas offered himself as a betrayer that things took a different course. And of course, Jesus had already told Judas to go and do what he had agreed to do. Now, it had to be Passover. Why? Well, Passover, of course, was the annual festival celebrated by Jews the world over, even today, marking their wonderful escape from Egypt, from slavery, through the desert, becoming the people of God, entering the new land, entering the freedom that God had promised them. And Passover marked the night when the final 10th plague took place, the death of the firstborn, when the angel of death moved throughout the land of Egypt. And the Jewish people were all protected because in obedience to God, they had killed a lamb and put its blood up on the lintels and doorposts of their houses. And the angel passed them by and their lives were saved when the firstborn of the land of Egypt were killed. Now, this was celebrated, of course, because it was the beginning of the nation. And what Jesus had come to do was to bring freedom, not from physical slavery, but from the slavery of sin and so on, and to bring the world into a new freedom. He was to be the fulfiller of Passover. And the night before he died, of course, the meal he shared with the disciples was Passover. And Jesus took bread and wine and said, "This is my body, this is my blood. There is new meaning coming here in what I'm about to do. This is God's timing. Now is the right moment." And it's a very interesting little detail of the crucifixion, actually, that when Jesus was hanging on the cross, for 3 hours, there was total darkness over the land. And if you look back to Exodus and the story of Passover, you find that the penultimate plague, the ninth plague, was darkness. And it was followed by the death of the firstborn. Jesus is fulfilling Passover, no longer just for the Jews, but for everyone in the world. So Jesus chose to die. He chose where. He chose when. And I would go on to say Jesus even chose how to die. Now, some people might say, well, okay, Jesus needs to die. That's part of his mission, but it doesn't really much matter how it happens. So maybe if he died of old age or had a heart attack or something, that would have still worked, wouldn't it? Well, I don't think it would. You see, if Herod had got him when he was a boy, he would have died by the sword. If he'd thrown himself off the cliff in the desert, that would have been that. Similarly, off the one in Nazareth, he could have drowned. Would that have worked if Jesus was drowned for us? It's worth thinking about, isn't it? Or if he'd been stoned to death for us, I mean, he'd still be martyred, so doesn't that work? No, Jesus died hanging on a tree, strung up on a Roman cross. Now, the Romans were the only people who could pass that sentence on anybody. So it had to be a Roman decision to do that. But Jesus had already said during his lifetime, if I be lifted up, if I'm lifted up, I will draw all men to me. In John 3, just before the famous verse, God so loved the world, there's a reference to Moses and lifting up the serpent in the wilderness. So must the Son of Man be lifted up. Well, if you look back to the story, you see that there was a plague of snakes that were going slithering round and biting and killing people in the desert during part of the wanderings round there. And Moses cried out to God and said, look, we need to do something about this. Please, how we can stop this. And he was told by God to make a bronze snake and put it up on a pole and to raise it up above the people, with the promise that if they look up to it, believing that that will make a difference, the plague will go. And it did. You can say, well, how on earth is putting a bronze serpent up on a pole going to make any difference if you've been bitten with snake venom? And I don't know how that works. It doesn't, does it? But when God says it'll work, it works. And Jesus said, just as Moses lifted up the serpent in the wilderness, so must the Son of Man be lifted up. And that's the manner for God so loved the world. God loved the world in this way so much that he gave his one and only Son to be lifted up. But there's more to it than that. There is an explicit verse in the law of the Old Testament in Deuteronomy that says that anybody who is hanged on a tree, executed in that way, is specifically cursed by God. Now, the fact that people knew about that is obvious because it was one of the main reasons that the early Christians had a problem proclaiming Jesus as the Jewish Messiah to Jewish people. Because they said, that's impossible. How can our Messiah be cursed by God in the manner of his death? It proves he was false and a fraud. But Paul in Galatians 3 makes a brilliant argument. He says that in the Old Testament, basically, we have a choice, the kind of choices that Amanda was talking about a little while ago, and a rather more significant one. You have a choice between life and death. You have a choice between blessing and curse, following and trusting God, or rebelling and going your own way and disobeying. And the tragedy, of course, is that all of us, to greater or lesser extents, have turned aside from what God wants for our lives. And so by nature, by sinful nature, we are under God's curse. The curse that the law brings is upon us. The wages of sin is death, as Paul puts it in Romans. So what has happened when Jesus died? In the manner of his death, says Paul, he becomes a curse for us, so that we might receive the blessing of God. It's a brilliant piece of insight, because Jesus embraced the curse that is rightly ours in order that the blessing that is rightly his can become ours. And the blessing that God promised to go to the whole world through Abraham, he goes on to say, can take place through the ministry of the Spirit. So it wasn't sufficient that Jesus just died by drowning for us. He embraced the curse of God upon sinful people in his dying. He became sin for us, says Paul in Corinthians, so that we, through his death, might become the righteousness of God. Jesus chose how to die. Astonishing, incredible. Cleopas wouldn't have known that day. It must have not just been awful because it was a death and Jesus was gone, but because it was crucifixion. Died cursed by God. And there's one last thing that follows from all of this. It means if Jesus chose to die, and he chose where, and he chose when, and he chose how, then he also chose why. The meaning of his death is not something we try to work out. It's something that he puts into it, and we can now see. He spoke of himself as the good shepherd who was going to give his life for the sheep. He spoke of giving himself as a ransom for many, a payment that brings freedom. He uses the language of sacrifice, offering himself, giving himself. God so loved the world that he gave his son, gave him to us, gave him for us, and he gives himself for us. Now, if Jesus died for us in any sense, and Paul certainly develops this in later on in the New Testament for us, what does it mean? It must surely mean instead of us, on our behalf. The love of God is demonstrated in the cross, not because Jesus is looking down lovingly upon us, but because in love he is doing something for us, something that we cannot do, something which only he can do. He is the one who gives meaning to his death. There on the cross, as he hangs there, he prays forgiveness for those who have put him there. They know not what they're doing, he says. But of course, for forgiveness to flow, blood has to be shed. It's there in the Old Testament. It's part of the way God does things. And Jesus not only speaks forgiveness and says, I want to forgive you, but prays that his Father will forgive them. And in his very dying is the means by which that forgiveness can happen. And so Jesus is not a victim. He is fully in control. With the benefit of hindsight, we can see that. Cleopas didn't have hindsight on that day. And the disciples, trying to make sense both of the resurrection, the fact that Jesus was with them now, And what does that mean about who he is and his ministry and what he's been doing? And most of all, why he's died? Through the lens of the resurrection, we Christians have hindsight that makes sense of Jesus, of his life, of his death, of what God has been working out throughout history. Because though we have to live our lives in the moment, as we call it, we have eyes that can understand God working his purposes out. So as we look back from the place we're in now to the cross, we see Jesus fully in control. Yes, certainly, people are conspiring to do away with him. People are denying him. People are betraying him. People are saying false things about him. People are spitting at him and doing all the stuff that's there. But ultimately, he is in control. He is doing what the Father has given him to do out of love for me and for you, for the needs of the world. This is what Jesus has come to do. And he chooses the place and the time and the manner and the meaning.